Bringing GMO into that is the equivalent of simply pouring poison on the fields. Why do that?
The U.S. government has made genetic manipulation, the spread of GMO seeds, patented seeds from Monsanto, Dow, DuPont, and others, a national security priority. It's tantamount to the export of defense weapons for the Pentagon and for the U.S. budget. It's a national security export sector, agribusiness, and especially patented seeds, GMO seeds from Monsanto and company.
If you could just give us a quick, you're a best-selling author. You've written on different subjects. I use your book, Gods of Money, in one of my other classes on U.S. foreign policy.
Okay.
And we read a chapter from Seeds of Destruction. Mm-hmm. This course is called Environment and International Relations. Mm-hmm. And if you give us a quick background of yourself, as well as if you can just quickly break down the GMO agenda for us.
Okay. That's a tall order. The second one, anyway. Well, I was born in the States, right around the end of World War II. I'm in my 60s now. And after studying at Princeton in the U.S. and at Stockholm in Sweden, in economics in Sweden, comparative international economics, I began work in New York as a freelance journalist, working on the energy crisis of the 1970s. In 1973, when OPEC price of oil went up 400% within a matter of months. And then gradually different events led me to end up in Germany, also working as an economist, a journalist, and an editor for a small magazine in Germany. Then I gradually got in through my work on oil. I'd done extensive work on oil in Texas and across the United States with independent oil producers there, and began to realize the power of one particular family, a family whose name is well known to most people in Mexico who know anything about history, and that is the Rockefeller family. And I suppose I got a little bit fascinated by the power of this family and the way they operated with oil. But then as I dug more deeply, I produced a book called Century of War, Anglo-American Oil Politics and the New World Order, which has now been translated into 10 foreign language editions from Chinese, Japanese, Korean, Russian, French, German, Italian. Well,
I've had a cousin of mine had a professor assigned that at her university in Croatia. So
yeah,
Croatia as well.
Well, in Croatia, the book is it was number one on the nonfiction bestseller list for almost a year back 10 years back when the internal Croatian, Serbian, Bosnian madness was reigning. And people told me that that book was required reading in the military war college of Croatia to understand geopolitics and global politics and how Croatia was being manipulated in that war. So then actually some years later, I was approached by my Croatian editor, in fact, as it were, for a second book. She and her husband had started a small independent publishing house, and she very much wanted to do a second book for me. And I said, well, I have two themes that I'm working on. One of them is GMO, genetic manipulation of genetically manipulated organisms, GMO. She said, well, that's a very hot issue in Croatia. We'd very much want to have that book if you can do it. So that was around 2004. I set to work on researching. And as I dug in, I write books to learn things, I suppose, more than anything, but also to try to explain for people who otherwise wouldn't have access to it, the deeper aspects of many of the things that affect our daily lives, important things, not just oil and energy, but food, the military, the Pentagon strategy and whatnot. And as you point out, with the gods of money, the Wall Street manipulations that affect our entire lives. So as I dug more deeply, I came across the fact that the Rice Institute, as in eating rice, rice and beans, the Rice Institute in the Philippines, which was originally created by the Rockefeller Foundation, initiated the first research in what they called golden rice, vitamin A enhanced rice was the idea, and that they wanted to create a genetically manipulated strain of rice and pitch that on the developing world, especially in Asia. That's the, if you will, that's the corn of the Asian diet, rice, corn in Mexico and rice in Asia. And when I learned that the Rockefeller Foundation actually spearheaded the first research grants into genetic manipulation, that really perked my ears up. And I dug deeper. And the more deeply I dug, the more shocked, I suppose. I don't know if I get shocked anymore these days. I've been at this for about 37 years. But the more I realized this was a very, very big story, and that nobody to date that I was aware of in the English-speaking world, certainly, had looked at the question of GMO from the standpoint of eugenics. Now, for those of you who don't know what eugenics is, it's what Hitler and the Third Reich practiced to people they considered the unfortunate, useless eaters. They did forced sterilization experiments and all sorts of things. And as I dug into the eugenics subject, I realized that the largest financial patron of eugenics in the Third Reich from the 1920s, late 1920s, all through until 1939 and the outbreak of the Second World War with the march into Poland, was in fact the Rockefeller Foundation. So then I spent a considerable amount of research going into this whole Rockefeller eugenics track. And I found in the minutes of one of the meetings of the American Eugenics Society, whose president was a connected with the Rockefeller Foundation, that they said after World War II and the discovery of the Holocaust and the gas ovens and so forth, and Nuremberg trials, they said, from this point on, the new name of eugenics is genetics. And the Rockefeller Foundation actually financed a field of biology that's based on a fraud, a scientific fraud called reductivism. I'm sure many of your students being a technical university are familiar with what scientific reductivism is, but basically it's the idea that you can reduce life down to a single gene. And if you isolate that gene, you can manipulate that gene's characteristics or traits and create almost anything you want, a Frankenstein monster, what will you? And this had been the dream of the Rockefellers, the DuPonts, the Colgates, these enormously wealthy American oligarchs, if you want to call them something, for decades. The idea of creating a, if you will, a master race of people like them. They look in the mirror and think that's the model. For some reason. But and then they would have a means also to control the rest of us, whom they consider more or less as ants of a certain sort to be used for work and certain chores, but not much else, and to make sure the population doesn't get restive and decide they want more of the pie. So I followed that track on eugenics, and that became a guiding thread of the book as it developed. So what I found in the course of actually researching the GMO itself, and I was in touch with some of the world's leading GMO scientists, who biologists who at first were convinced that GMO was really a step forward for mankind. It would solve the problems of world hunger. It would eliminate large amounts of pesticides or herbicides on plants, because it would make the plants resistant to to certain insects and so forth. This was the dawn of a new miracle age of microbiology. Well,
some of the students since you're on that issue were wondering, are there really any good? Is there any potential for good from the GMO that you can see from your research?
No, and I say this very bluntly. It's an entire marketing fraud that Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, DuPont, BASF in Germany, the GMO giants, have promoted, especially Monsanto, that there is all of these positive benefits from GMO. The only major crops in the world today that are GMO are soybeans and corn, and the only characteristic that they have, the modification, makes them resistant to, let's take the case of Monsanto soybean and corn, it makes the corn resistant to one of the most toxic weed killers known to man called Roundup. Its active ingredient is glyphosate, and they add to it different chemicals, proprietary chemicals. They don't even reveal what, so they can't be tested independently. But French biologists who've tested that in leading French laboratories have found that the ingredients in glyphosate and Roundup actually are toxic to cells in a human embryo. Now, that's pretty scary stuff. And in concentrations less than that used by many people around the world in their garden to kill weeds. Roundup is the largest weed killer in the world, largest selling. So there are no documentable, independently verifiable accounts of increases of harvest yield owing to GMO. There are short-term increases, one or two harvest seasons, and then it drops dramatically. The same thing with the use of herbicides. They claim it uses less herbicides. Well, there's something called nature, and nature is a ferocious fighter. So nature has developed a Roundup-resistant superweed, and this is plaguing farmers all across America. These superweeds are such that you cannot get rid of the superweeds on your cropland. They just choke off the plants and they strangle everything. So the idea, and then you have to pour more and more herbicides on your crops, and pretty soon your crops are nothing but poison coating an ear of corn or soybeans. So all of the claims, the positive claims for GMO are simply marketing fraud, and that can be verified. I go through it in some detail in the book, but I encourage your students, if they're interested, to search for themselves, because there's ample evidence that you can find through searches on the internet.
Right. About a week ago, I read that Roundup is being found in people's urine right now. So,
it's scary stuff. Scary stuff. And there are no, owing to the fact that George Bush Sr., George Herbert Walker, in 1992 had a closed-door White House meeting with the top people at Monsanto from St. Louis, who convinced him that GMO was going to put American agriculture as the world agriculture giant, because then farmers would have to buy patented seeds. They couldn't reuse the seeds for the next harvest, because they would have to come back to Monsanto every year for the new seeds, and also for the Roundup that it's paired to. So it would create a captive market for American agriculture exports. On that basis, Bush Sr. issued a decree within the agencies of the U.S. government, Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and so forth, all the responsible agencies for food safety, and said, all GMO products will be treated, GMO corn will be treated as equivalent to normal corn. And it's called the Doctrine of Substantial Equivalence. Now, if you have any legal background, you'll realize that the terminology substantial equivalence is legal rubbish. Either it's equivalent, meaning exactly equal in biological effects and everything else, or it's not. So by introducing a vague concept, the Bush administration in 1992 ensured that there would be no government independent testing of the health and safety of GMO products, and there is not until this day. The man who is President Obama's advisor at the FDA for GMO and food safety and so forth, Michael Taylor, is the former attorney in Washington for Monsanto. So it's a closed-door corporativist locked-in system that's pushing this. And every president from Bush in 92 has embraced GMO as a national priority. So that tells you something about the power of this thing.
And where do you see it now? Because it seems like they're speeding up. The USDA last week is coming out. They're fast-tracking GMO legislation. I know in Croatia, say 5 or 6 years ago, I'd go to my local market and I'd find homegrown food people were selling. And now when I go there, they're buying from the big warehouses and corporations and pawning it off as their own. And so it's getting much harder to find natural products.
Yeah, that is a real problem. In Germany, where I live and where I'm talking from right now, there's an extremely powerful grassroots movement of consumers, of farmers, and so forth, who demand labeling, number one, of GMO products, and number two, have declared entire areas of Germany, farm areas, to be GMO-free. And the farmers network through things like Twitter and so forth, the same way that these, Twitter, that kind of thing, or through emails and internet. And they spread the word about these kinds of things. Farmers who've had experiences with GMO corn, I know one very personally from North Hessen near where I am. And he's gone to Switzerland, to Austria, across Germany and so forth to tell of the fact that it absolutely destroyed his farmland. The soil has been made toxic for 7 years, according to soil samples that he had independently tested as a result of the GMO corn that he fed his cattle. So there's a very strong resistance in Europe to GMO, and that's made it very difficult for the bureaucrats in Brussels, and the European Food Safety Administration is a bought entity of Monsanto and the GMO giants. That's a sad fact of life. But the populations, they forced the government in Berlin to back down on approving a variety of GMO Monsanto corn 2 years ago. And that was a very, very big upset for Monsanto. They thought they had it in the bag.
While we get some students lined up to ask a question, so any students who would like to ask a question, perhaps take a seat here so you can ask on the microphone. And so while some students work up the courage, let me ask you one final question. Yeah. So we've been studying climate change and environmental issues, and Bill Gates seems to be at the center of this nexus. So, you know, he's spoken about CO2 and climate change. Then he's involved in the vaccines, and he discusses how the need to reduce, you know, populations up like by 15%, where he mentioned at the TED talk.
Yeah.
And now he's also very heavily involved in genetic modification, and some of the risks we see are infertility, sterility, you know, rats dying, getting cancer.
Sure.
Can you just quickly boil down what's the nexus there?
Well, the Gates Foundation is a very important factor. Gates, the foundation, bought a major, major share. They own a major share of Monsanto Corporation. They're pushing through their project in Africa for a green revolution in Africa, so-called. They're pushing GMO seeds on the African agriculture and the African populations. They're trying to, in any case. Africa is resistant to this. Africa has some of the purest, untainted topsoil, the finest topsoil on the planet Earth. And they have the capacity, it's been estimated, to alone Africa to feed 12 billion people. So there is no shortage of ability to produce high quality food in natural ways that can feed our planet. So that's one reason the Gates Foundation is in Africa. The man who at the Gates Foundation makes the decisions on strategy is not only Bill Gates, but the father of Bill Gates, who was the president of a eugenics organization closely supported by the Rockefeller family called the Planned Parenthood. So Gates is all over the place on this question of eugenics and tying in GMO as well as vaccines. He wants to vaccinate every African child, multiple vaccines. And this gets into a topic that is very emotional for me. I sit in a wheelchair, according to one virologist, as a consequence of a smallpox vaccine adjuvant that created paralysis when I was 5, and they called it in those days polio. But the idea of vaccinating children across Africa, Bill Gates, if he were honest and genuinely cared about human lives in Africa, he would spend his billions instead of on vaccines that lame and cripple people, they would spend that on purifying the water supplies, which can be done rather cheaply in most places. So that's the number one cause of diseases in children in Africa.
Any questions? Anyone like to ask?
And you can be critical. I'm open to any kind of questions. If you think I'm
just laying down the gauntlet.
G'day. I was just curious, are you against all types of genetic modification, or like, is there, to my understanding, a difference between genetic modification and genetically modified organisms? Like, I read, for instance, that the main or one of the main technologies that was used to create insulin shots for people with diabetes comes from genetic modification technologies.
Yeah. Scientists I've talked with, including Dr. Arpad Pusztai, who in the 1990s was the world's leading researcher in the biological effects of GMO, have told me that GMO is inherently, there's no technology in the world known today by which GMO manipulation of the genes of a plant with foreign material, a bacillus or whatever, is stable. It's always turned on. It's inherently instable, and no one knows over the long term what the effects of that will be on other plants, on non-GMO plants, whatever. So it's there is no, and I've talked with leading, a member of the original team in American University at Yale, who's a very, very close friend of mine. He was a biologist and a chemist and was chosen to be on this cross interdisciplinary team at Yale to develop techniques for GMO back in the 80s. And he fully agrees that this stuff, there is no technology of genetic manipulation that is inherently positive or safe or stable. We just...
I'm kind of going back to like biology a few years ago, but what about things like recombinant DNA and making plasmids for... I think they changed the DNA in bacteria, and I think, don't they use that as a type of vaccination? I might be wrong on that.
I think vaccinations in general are something that human beings ought to avoid, and animals too. That's a very blunt statement, but I have yet to see competent proof that any vaccination has brought health to any group population group, and it's brought a lot of diseases and illnesses. I don't think we need vaccinations. We need healthy food. And if we break the agribusiness monopolization, the Rockefellers created agribusiness as a project out of Harvard Business School in the 50s to do with the human food chain, to control life and do with the human food chain what they had done with the oil, to create a global monopoly of food, the processing distribution, where the family farmer becomes the most insignificant link in the chain instead of what he should be, the most significant link for healthy food and nutrition for us. So and they've been remarkably successful. Look at the epidemic of diabetes in America today from processed food through agribusiness, high fructose corn syrup in almost everything we eat, the soft drinks that we drink, aspartame and things like that, or now stevia extracts that are toxic based on the stevia plant in South America. So the industrialization of our food supply has created enormous profits, enormous concentration, like you mentioned in Croatia, so that these big marketers can undercut local producers and bankrupt them and replace it with junk, essentially junk that's slowly poisoning us. It doesn't happen overnight. It takes maybe 20 years before all sorts of symptoms like arthritis and diabetes and so forth manifest themselves. But that is happening in spades. And it's about 20 to 25 years since there's been this massive industrialization of the food that we eat in the United States and Europe and so forth.
Cool. Thank you.
Any other questions? We have from France, a student.
You have an international student body, huh?
Yeah.
Do you think that it will be possible to feed 10 billion of people without GMO?
To feed?
I couldn't
hear you on the microphone.
Yeah. Do you think it will be possible to feed, like, in a few years, about 10 billion of people?
Sure.
Without the GMO?
Sure. Absolutely. Well, GMO will make it impossible to feed 10 billion people because the harvest yields will be less than what we have with conventional agriculture. So, and estimates by UN experts on agriculture are that Africa alone, only Africa, could feed 12 billion people, and we have the rest of the planet. Now, the problem is in industrial countries like the United States and much of Europe, since World War II, we have over-farmed and over-chemicaled, well, it's not really a word, but overused chemicals on the agriculture lands, which have, in effect, destroyed much of the microorganisms and made the soil infertile for the nutrients that we need in our food. So Africa and places, parts of Russia, ironically, and Ukraine and so forth in Eastern Europe are some of the few remaining not destroyed agriculture lands on the planet. And there's ample possibility to feed 10 billion people. I'm not at all worried about that.
And can we transform the field where there were GMO? Is it possible to use this field with non-GMO or no?
I'm told it is. It takes about 7 years. So it's not something that you don't want to turn your whole agriculture the way the United States has done over to GMO or the country of Argentina. They have more or less surrendered the land to GMO for soybeans in Argentina, for corn and soybeans in the United States. And that will take years to undo. Plus, you've had the introduction of agriculture chemicals on a massive scale in places like Kansas, Iowa, where the corn is concentrated. And that's going to take years to bring those soils back to life, and a lot of care and attention.
Okay. Just the last one. It seemed to me that Monsanto has a very big power in the food supply. Is it still the case today or no?
Sure. Monsanto has enormous influence in much in the same way Goldman Sachs does in the world of banking and finance. Everywhere around the world where there's a big push to force governments or convince them to take GMO, whether it's Indonesia, whether it's China, whatever, and certainly in Europe, you scratch a little bit and you'll find Monsanto. You'll have pro-biotechnology. Biotechnology is another word for genetic manipulation, by the way. Pro-biotechnology foundations, and you'll find that all the key people on those foundations, professors, university professors, are linked to Monsanto research grants or monies in one way or another if you do the research.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Looks like we're out of time. If you can tell us, I believe you have a new book coming out titled something like Energy Wars.
Well, the actual title will be Myths, Lies, and Oil Wars. And it goes into essentially concentrates on the last 50 or 60 years of the use by American big oil and British big oil primarily, of various means to secure a monopoly on world energy, because after 1945, Europe converted from coal to oil and more or less the world economy became dependent on oil, and it documents how they used a myth of scarcity. It's sometimes called the peak oil myth, and it's complete rubbish. And I document the origins of the myth, how it was encouraged by Shell Oil, where the the godfather of the myth, King Hubbard, was employed in the 50s when he delivered this paper to the American Petroleum Association. And it's based on not one shred of scientific evidence. It's based on a pure idealistic model that he posits called the Gaussian curve. Anyone who studied science knows that the Gauss curve is an idealistic heurism, but it's not a description of physical reality. And even Gauss said it was a heurism. It was just an attempt to make a point in one of his arguments. So the book documents both how wars have been used, the war between Iraq and Iran back in the 80s, Operation Desert Storm in the early 90s, the latest Iraq war in 2003, how that's been used to control the world's oil supplies and create this illusion of scarcity. Now, if people believe that we're running out of oil, then they're more liable to accept the idea that gasoline is going to cost in the United States $4 or $5 a barrel. What can we do about it? We're running out of oil. Well, that's rubbish. We're running into oil. Look at what's going on in offshore Brazil. Look at what's going on in the Eastern Mediterranean, of all places, between Greece, Cyprus, Syria. I've just written a series of articles on this. They have discovered some of the largest natural gas fields in the Eastern Mediterranean, offshore Israel and Lebanon, that have been discovered in the world in the past 10 years. And there's some big gas fields that have been discovered in Qatar and Iran in the Persian Gulf. So we're running into oil, and the big oil companies, Halliburton, Schlumberger, all the network associated with the Anglo-American big oil monopoly, are trying everything to keep this myth alive about peak oil, that we're running out of oil, that it's scarcity, and therefore we have to have such a high price. So the book details that, and also where the origins of this idea of global warming, which certainly isn't the reality. We're in a cyclical climate that's influenced by the solar flares and explosions on the sun more than anything that man does on this earth. So, and that determines cold and wet cycles on a periodic basis over history. So the climate fraud it's beginning to be exposed as the fake science that it is, and the scientists have been simply bought and paid for by interests that have created things like the Chicago Climate Exchange, which is now defunct, fortunately, but they moved the operation over to London. And they're trying to create a business in trading carbon credits and do for CO2, perfectly harmless gas, do with that what they've done with oil futures. So that's the kind of thing that the book deals with.
And when is it coming out, tentatively?
If all goes well, I'm working on the cover for the thing now. The text is in its final editing, it's almost completed. So it should be out, available through Amazon US and through that internationally, also in ebook form a little bit later in the late spring. I estimate around May.
And can you gauge your next topic on the horizon that you might be dealing with?
I'd like to hold back on that for now.
All right.
Several things, they're all a little bit controversial, so I want to be ready for it.
And finally, so we're here in a, you know, in the university setting, and typically a lot of students and will learn a more politically correct version, and I tend to push more towards the politically incorrect as we've gotten into heated debates in this classroom. Cool. And from perhaps from colleagues of yours or your own experience, what advice might you give for people in an educational setting such as this while studying these types of topics?
Don't accept anything you read as truth unless you've tested it independently for yourself and for your own satisfaction. Not what your professors tell you, including you, with all due respect. Not what I tell you. Don't accept anything. Be skeptical in a healthy way and test everything for your own satisfaction before you say this is what's going on. Otherwise, you're just repeating opinions that people have told you is the way it should be, and most of those opinions in today's world are unfortunately rubbish. So test and check and question everything, and then you'll have a lively mind that'll live for a long time.
Okay, well, Mr. Engdahl, thank you for your time
and
for joining us at such a late hour.
I hope it was useful.
It was very useful.
Immensely.
Good night.
Good night.